Record producer Joel Dorn, a respected influential figure in both pop and jazz music, died this week of a heart attack. He was 65. Dorn worked at Atlantic Records for nearly 15 years. He produced Grammy-winning recordings by Bette Midler and Roberta Flack. In the jazz section of the company, he produced albums with Les McCann, Eddie Harris, Razan Roland Kirk, and Mose Allison. After leaving Atlantic Records, Dorn started a number of specialty labels which focused on live or reissued recordings. His Night label featured live club recordings like this one with Eddie Harris. Eddie Harris, recorded live in San Francisco in 1978. Joel Dorn's Night label featured recordings which were made when the musicians had no idea they were even being recorded. Tapes made by amateurs and club owners. Tapes never intended for commercial release. Terry spoke to Dorn after he launched the label. She asked him how he found some of the tapes.
I have a friend named Bernard Drayton who is black. When he was young, which was the late 50s, early 60s, there were no black recording engineers in the studios in New York. There just weren't. But he wanted to become a recording engineer. So he bought his own little Radio Shack level remote equipment. I'm talking about a tape recorder, a microphone, a mixing board. Prevailed upon the jazz musicians in New York. He was one of those kids, you know, who was always backstage or trying to get in clubs or stuff. Prevailed upon the musicians that when they worked their gigs, not in Manhattan, not at Birdland or the Village Gate or those places, but when they worked out in the boroughs, Brooklyn, the Bronx, and these little tiny clubs, when they would get their material together for their recordings for the New York jazz labels, they let him record these gigs under the set of rules for it was you could never release it, and it was just, you know, basically it was give a brother a break, you know. They were letting him record these gigs so that he could learn how to become a recording engineer. And he did it with the understanding that he would never release them or play them for anybody else. Boom. It's 30 years later. I'm sitting in his office in November of 1986. And we had talked about these tapes off and on for years. And we had had a meeting about something else and casually said to him, I said, Bernie, maybe we should do something with those tapes of yours. Now it's 30 years later. Let me see if I can go get the clearances.
Did your friend Bernie Drayton record the Eddie Harris record?
No. We got those tapes from Eddie Harris, so we had some stuff from San Francisco, some stuff from Chicago. We called it A Tale of Two Cities, you know.
No, and the Eddie Harris record, one of the tracks, has him doing basically like an impersonation of Billie Holiday, but he's not singing. He's kind of doing it into his saxophone.
That particular cut was done in San Francisco at the Keystone Corner. And what he does is he does an impersonation of Billie Holiday through some kind of electronic thing that he does through the saxophone. So he evokes that Billie Holiday sound without actually ever saying words. It's vocalese. But the strings and the piano, he plays them too. And they're operated by foot controls. So he stands on stage alone with a saxophone. It looks like he's playing it, but he's singing into it. With his left foot, he controls the piano. With his right foot, he controls the string orchestra. And he just does it.
Recorded the Ross and Roland Kirk sessions that you used.
Once again, that was done in San Francisco at Keystone Corner, but also in New Orleans and also in Paris. A variety of sources. We listened to 178 tapes to get, I think, 53 minutes of Rossan.
One of the things that Kirk used to always do at conferences was play three horns at one time, three saxophones at a time.
Right.
And you have an example of him doing that on the record. Why did you want to get an example of him doing that live?
Well, number one, it was kind of the thing that people spoke about. When you speak of Razan Roland Kirk, they'll say, well, he was the blind guy who, and they'll always say, played three horns at once. That was, you know, his kind of his trademark. I remember the first time I saw it was here in Philadelphia at the Academy of Music in 1961. And I was watching backstage when he put those three horns in his mouth. First time I saw him, he was imitating the Ellington horn section. And it absolutely, watching him do it and looking out from backstage and seeing the audience react, it was like, well, we're on radio, so opening my mouth doesn't make any difference. But everybody, you know, was like gasping.
Cannonball Adderley on the record with him. There's a beautiful recording of Stars Fell on Alabama.
Yeah.
Tell me something about this recording and why you included it.
Well, I listened to 520 tapes to get the Les McCann record, 60 tapes to get the Eddie Harris record, 178 tapes to get the Rahsaan Roland Kirk record, two tapes to get the Cannonball Adderley. It just jumped out of the... It was just one of those nights where everything was right. We got those tapes from Las Vegas, a disc jockey who moved there from New York, who had done some live radio shows at the Half Note. I was always a big Cannonball Adderley fan. I was thrilled. And interestingly, that was a very rare period for Cannon. It was just before he became a big kind of like pop jazz artist, and it was just at the end of when he was a major commercial jazz and artistic jazz success, kind of on the cusp of careers. The interesting thing about Stars Fell in Alabama, if you listen to it, or an interesting thing to me is that was done New Year's Eve in 1967, or New Year's Eve 68, whatever, however it goes, in New York. And musicians traditionally hate to play New Year's. It's the worst time in the world. Everybody's drunk. Nobody cares. They're just out to scream and yell, you know, and get loaded. The audience is barely paying attention to them if you listen. There's a lot of noise. You hear all these conversations going on. And through all of this, on the worst night of the year for any musician, you just hear Cannon rise to this magnificent level. I thought that was a – he's recorded that song twice, and I heard him play it in person maybe a dozen times. He sounded like if Johnny Hodges and Bird had a son, it would have been Cannon then. And I thought it was a real touching performance.
Ask you, are any of the musicians getting angry at the people who recorded them without letting the musicians
Sometimes,
know what was happening?
I would say there are two instances. In the 4.5 years we've been doing it where two people got livid. At that point, we gave them the tapes, said, you know, sorry, if you're bugged, they're yours. Talk to you later.
Yeah.
Here's what I found. When I first went into this, one of the reasons I approached it with some kind of trepidation was people used to get livid when they found that they were recorded in an unauthorized manner. It's 30 years later. A lot of times that's the best work they ever did, or that period's never coming back again. Or they, instead of getting angry, they say, man, I thought I'd never hear me playing with so-and-so. Or that was a great period, you know. So it's different now. Is it all peaches and cream? Absolutely not. But I'd say 85-90% of the time people go, great, man, and love it.
Joel Dorn, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thanks.
Joel Dorn speaking to Terry Gross in 1991. He died this week at age 65.